and you are listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today on this October 23rd, 2012. How are you? I'm doing pretty well, and I'm glad you're joining me today. We've got a very interesting program lined up, and I know I'm going to be learning quite a bit. But before we get started, I wanted to remind you, for those of you who are familiar with my nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living Real, we're in our October fun drive. We're calling it the Real Virtual Pancake Breakfast Fundraiser, and you can go to our website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. You can download the sourdough cornmeal vegan gluten-free pancake recipe and have a good time with it. And also make a donation if you are so moved, because we could really use it. And we're doing lots of wonderful things for the planet with this organization. Thanks for your support in advance. responsibleeatingandliving.com. All right. My first guest is Tom Reagan. He is universally recognized as the intellectual leader of the animal rights movement. During his more than 30 years on the faculty of North Carolina State University, he received numerous awards for excellence in undergraduate and graduate teaching, was named University Alumni Distinguished Professor, published hundreds of professional papers and more than 20 books, won major international awards for film writing and direction, and presented hundreds of lectures throughout the United States and abroad. Upon his retirement in 2001, he received the William Quarles Holiday Medal, the highest honor North Carolina State University can bestow on one of its faculty. His wife, Nancy, and he co-founded the Culture and Animals Foundation. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Oh, it's my honor to be on your show. Thank you.
No. The honor is all mine. In fact, I was so honored when I first got to meet you earlier this year, and I'm so glad I did. Of course, it was kind of a bittersweet experience, as you may remember. We both went to the memorial of Marty Keel, who was a phenomenal author and activist.
She was a wonderful person.
And a wonderful person. And I want to say that I was fortunate to meet her shortly before she left this life. And the wonderful thing about that memorial was all of us who gathered afterwards. It was really a wonderful experience to be together with so many people who share the same dream of making this world a better, more kinder place.
Yeah, it was an inspiration to me, I can tell you, and to Nancy as well. We went home fueled with the compassion that we experienced at this memorial service and also at the table. So we were the better for having gone there.
Yeah, I agree. And inspiration is something that all of us need to get continually, because it's so easy to lose focus, be depressed, and because we're continually focusing on what is wrong. And
well, that's an astute observation, I think. The movement goes forward despite the people who leave it every day, because they're dispirited, because they're impatient, because they give up hope. And so it's like a revolving door. People come in and people go out. And our first obligation to the animals and to the earth is to stay in the movement, to keep making a contribution in our several ways, in our separate ways. But the enemy wins if we
go out the door. That's right. Have to stay with it and stay fueled and stay inspired. I like to keep things as positive as I possibly can, and we'll be focusing on both the good and the bad and hopefully leave with a lot of good. So if somebody saw you walking down the street, I don't think that they would think, oh, that's an animal rights activist.
And no, I don't think so either.
I don't think so. Now, the unfortunate thing is there are many stereotypes around the world for many different kinds of people and kinds of characters, and the animal rights activist is no different. There is a stereotype. I don't think it's true. There might be a smattering of people who fit whatever the stereotype may be, but you're a lovely, friendly, kind, soft-spoken, intelligent person.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, but yeah, I mean, I think that, of course, the public's image of an animal rights advocate is what the media feeds them, and mm-hmm. the media loves a plane crash. The media loves vandalism and violence. Just look at the front page of any newspaper in the world, and you'll confirm that for yourself. So our great struggle is to get past the media, so to speak. And the way we do that is by the example of our lives. Everybody makes a contribution to the struggle just by being compassionate in their life. And we must never forget that, because the animals and the planet depend on us for their safety and for their survival. Mm-hmm. So we must not abandon them. That's our first obligation.
People may or may not realize, I just want to briefly continue on the media concept, that what we see very often in mainstream media is the sensational, the violent. And we have so many great editing capabilities today that people don't even realize when they're watching maybe some live coverage or something. Very often a picture is spliced into it and may not even be from that event, but it's there to give us some subliminal thoughts and guide us along one direction. And we don't even realize very often what's happening.
No, I think you're correct about that. I mean, I'm not a keen student of the modern media, but I do know that subliminal messages can be placed in out of context.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it happens all the time. All right, just quick little history, how you got to where your thinking is today and what inspired you to write your animal rights books.
Well, actually, the thing that I was a butcher when I was in college. I sliced, I diced, I minced, I ground. Mm. And as I've said in the past, their cold flesh gave way to my cruel will. I mean, the pieces of meat that I was working with might as well have been blocks of wood. I was so distant from any kind of identification or any kind of the spark of compassion. Not that I was intentionally cruel to the companion animals in my life. They were always special. But the other animals were like blocks of wood mm-hmm. to me. And it may have stayed that way in my life, except for the head and the heart. The head was I was involved in the anti-war movement, and I, in the Vietnam period, my wife Nancy and I founded the North Carolinians Against the War, a statewide grassroots organization. I thought, I'm a trained philosopher, I should be able to make a contribution, a philosophical contribution, to the anti-war movement. And I remember this as clear as if this happened yesterday. I was in the university library and I took down a book, and by an author whose name I recognized, but I had never read anything by him. And his name, the title of the book was My Experiments with Truth, and it was written by Mohandas K. Gandhi, mm-hmm. better known as Mahatma Gandhi. And Gandhi had an enormous influence on me. Basically, he said, not that he literally said this, I wasn't hallucinating, but it was as if he said to me from the pages of his work, I understand, Professor Reagan, that you're against unnecessary violence. And I said, yes, that's why I'm campaigning against the war. And he said, well, what are those dead body parts doing in your freezer then? And that was like a lightning bolt of thought. Of course, these animals met a violent end, and I was living my life according to my commitment to nonviolence, and there were dead body parts in my freezer. And that was an enormous, had an enormous influence on me. And then secondly, the hard matter was when we had a dog who was hit and died, and hit by a car and died because of someone's irresponsibility. And it just awoke in my heart, in the sense that I thought, if any other dog was in my life as this dog had been, I would have felt just as bad, just as hurt, just as sorrowful. And then it was a short step for me to say, but by golly, if I had knew a pig as well, or a cow as well, or a chicken as well, I would have felt the same way. Mm-hmm. And the loss of this creature. So it was a combination of the head, my thought was Gandhi, and the heart with the death of a dear friend. So, and then that was 40 years ago when that happened. So we've seen a lot of water go over the dam and that, and since then.
Yeah, well, now
but that's how I got interested.
Yeah, it's a good story, and I always think it's important to tell the individual stories, because we all relate so much more, and we're so overwhelmed with the numbers. You know, we hear 60 billion land animals, plus or minus a few billion, are killed every year around the world. That's just an overwhelming number. But when we can look into the eyes of a hog, or look into the eyes of a cow or a chicken, I think it's a very different thing to see the individual personality and the life.
Well, the thing is that to my way of thinking over time has really become simplified. There are some bodies, there are not some things. They're the subject of a life, not a life without a subject. The other animals they're in the world, they're aware of the world, they're aware of what happens to them, and what happens to them matters to them because it makes a difference in the duration and the quality of their life. And in this respect, they are fundamentally the same as you and I. And so it is that, from my perspective, we should not do to them what we would not have done to us. And it's really the application of the golden rule. We don't want to turn them into meat, turn them into clothes, turn them into competitors, turning them into performers, turning them to tools in laboratories. We wouldn't want that done to us. And so, given our subjective equality, we should not be doing that to them. It's really very simple to me.
Yeah, it's simple to me too, and it's so hard to find the ways to get that message across to as many people as we can. It's amazing how difficult it is. We live in a very violent world. We're violent very often to the people around us, whether we know them or not. We're violent to the earth in many ways, we exploit so many things, people, animals, resources. It's just kind of part of human nature.
Well, it does seem to be, for sure. I think that our mind is tickled by the violence that we see around us. It's almost an act of will to keep the true violence alive in one's mind rather than to deny it or to bury it or to forget it or whatever. It's very important to keep our sense of violence in the world alive. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you see of tens of thousands of chickens in a battery hen house, and you don't see the violence, you don't see what's being done to these animals, then you're really not living in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's our obligation to keep our sense of violence alive in our life. Not that we practice it, but that we are aware of it, aware of what others do not see. That's the case. They don't see
it.
What's being done.
Yeah. There's horrible things going on every day all around the world. And I remember when September 11th, 2001 occurred, many of us were feeling it because it was so close to home, especially here in New York City. And
yeah.
One of the things that I kept saying to everyone I possibly could was, you're feeling overwhelmed. We don't know what to do. The thing that we can do is get the violence out of our own lives.
Yeah.
And we do that by what we eat and the products we use.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. You know, there's an image I sometimes use when I'm giving talks, and it's what I call the web of evil. And you say you have this picture of this enormous, complicated web. And as long as we're alive, we're going to be someplace in that web. We're going to be imperfect creatures in an imperfect world. We're going to contribute to the evil that is being done, either by actively or passively accepting it. But what we can struggle to do is to get as far from the center of the web as we can, to get, you know, because that's where the people who are perpetrators or viewers of evil don't recognize that the evil they do or see.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people in the center of the web, and we have to struggle as best we can to get as far from that center as we can. Well, knowing that we're not going to be perfect in any way, shape, or form, we're just going to be limited creatures in an imperfect world. But we can make a difference by trying to get away from the center.
Right. Now,
the other thing, there's another image, if I may.
Yes, please.
I sometimes picture this enormous wall that represents the oppression of other sentient life and the ecosystems and so on. And, of course, what we would like to do is to bring that wall down all at once and collapse and whatever. But if we're honest with ourselves, we know we can't do that. But what we can do is we can take the wall down a brick at a time. And that takes enormous stamina and courage and hard work and so on, just to take one brick down, just to end greyhound racing in Texas, or just to get chimps out of laboratories. You know, it's just one brick, but it takes an enormous amount of time and effort.
It does, and I fight that whole, you're right about this brick concept, but I always try to get people to see the whole picture, to see the whole wall.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah, it's hard.
We're so used to seeing some things that we no longer see them. We're so used to seeing animal abuse in factory farms and in laboratories and in marine display. We're so insensitive to that because it's a part of our daily diet. in the world. But that's why we have to, some the people listening to your radio show, we all have to keep our sense of anger alive in response to the evil that people don't see.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned to me this war analogy. Could we just talk about a little bit about that?
Yeah, because when people try to find an analogy, the two most common ones are the slavery analogy and the Holocaust analogy.
Right.
And the slavery analogy has a point, up to a point, but it seems to break down when we think about it was normally in the interest of slave owners not to kill their slaves.
Mm.
But it is in the interest of hog farmers to kill their hogs.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this analogy there. And in the Holocaust analogy, there was, the Holocaust, the purpose of the Holocaust was to exterminate various groups of people, homosexuals, Jews, Seventh-day Adventists, I think there were, but to obliterate them, to take them off the face of the earth. But that's normally not what happens when humans dominate other animals. I mean, it may sometimes happen, but rarely, it's the exception, not the rule. And again, mm-hmm. when you think about what's in the interest of furriers and in the interest of hog pork producers is to have more animals to be exploited rather than exterminate them. So I've been thinking about, well, what is a better analogy? And I and it's the war analogy, like you've mentioned. It's the idea that what are the characteristics of wars? Well, individuals are injured, they're killed, they're imprisoned, and weapons are used. And if we think about how animals are exploited,
mm-hmm.
for example, in animal agriculture, they are imprisoned.
Definitely.
They are injured. They are killed. And and weapons are used. Now, the interesting thing is that, of course, they'll say, well, we use tools.
Mm-hmm.
We use stereotactic devices and rat guillotines or something. But they are, once you adopt the war analogy, that kind of thinking, you say, no, they're weapons. That's what they are. They're weapons used by the perpetrators of the war. Then the other thing about it is that this seems to put all the blame on the people who are directly exploiting the animals, and the consumer gets off scot-free. But no, if you think about war again, there's a group of people called mercenaries. And mercenaries are people who are paid to wage the war. And in the United States, the war for our independence from Great Britain, their Hessians were used. But that's what we do. We pay people to carry out the war on our behalf. If we're meat eaters, if we use cosmetics that have been tested on animals and wear fur and all the rest of that, we are paying people to carry out the war. That's what a consumer is, a consumer of those products. That's what that consumer is.
Our hands are not clean.
No. For sure. And at the same time, it's just so very important. I remember an experience that I had where a person came up after I gave a talk, and they said to me, well, what about plants?
Mm-hmm.
And this woman who was with me, a very accomplished philosopher, just went ballistic. She said, "I've heard this question 1,000 times, and I've got it." And she stormed off in a huff. And then later, she came back to me and she said, "I have to apologize. I'm so disappointed in my behavior, but I really have heard this question 1,000 times." And I said to her, in an uncommon moment of insight on my part, I think, but I said to her, "Yes, but that was the first time that person asked me that question."
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have to remember, that people can't hear you when you're shouting at them.
That's right.
It's a paradox, but they can't hear you when you're shouting at them. That's why Gandhi, part of the reason Gandhi had such a profound impact on my life was because he was so meek of a man, and yet so tough and resilient and committed. He won his country's independence.
Yep.
You can imagine that. This man who, when he died, had a dhoti, a pair of sandals, some glasses,
mm-hmm.
and a bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Those were, he brought down the might of the British Army.
With nothing but his own integrity.
Yeah.
Yeah, very powerful.
So he's still an inspiration to me.
We just have a few minutes, and I wanted to talk about the animal welfare versus animal rights debate. Is that a brick versus wall scenario?
Yeah, I guess. Not quite. There are incremental abolitionist steps you can take. You can end greyhound racing. You can end cosmetic testing. You can end toxicity testing. You can end dog labs, for example, as PCRM has successfully done. So there are abolitionists. It's not that, like, you're just reforming a practice and keeping it and making it more welfare respecting, but you are actually ending things. So you have to, I give a list of those sorts of campaigns in my book, Empty Cages. But I think, from my point of view, as long we view other animals as a culture, as our resources, and welfare reforms simply makes it more acceptable that we view other animals as our resources.
Right.
Because they're treated better, they can turn around, they can, whatever, but they're still our resources.
Yeah.
And so I'm opposed to welfare reforms because they don't really address the problem, and at the same time it makes meat consumption more socially acceptable. For example,
everybody pats themselves on the back saying, okay, we're doing a good thing. We're giving a little bigger cage to the chickens, but there's really no improvement at all.
No, that's why I've always said not larger cages, empty cages.
Empty cages.
I mean, that's the thing. Where empty cages means there's no animal who's our resource in that cage, and that's what we want to get there. So, and I don't think we do get there by making welfare reforms.
Okay, so you've been at this animal rights thing for a bunch of decades. Are we making headway?
Well, in some ways we are, in some ways we aren't. In terms of body count, I mean, in 1975, when I published my first, The Moral Basis of Vegetarianism, there was roughly 6 billion animals destroyed in the United States, and today there are in excess of 10 billion animals. Mm. So in terms of body count, no, we're going in the opposite direction, I would guess. But in terms, in other terms, when I retired from the university, they presented me with the highest honor, and they also invited me to establish the Tom Reagan Animal Rights Archive at the university library. I don't think that was thinkable when we started in 1972 or so. I don't think that was thinkable. It was impossible.
Yeah.
And if you look at the growth of academic courses in literature and in philosophy and law and sociology and anthropology and biology and so on, there was a point when we were, if you think of a university as a castle, that we were outside the moat. Now we're inside the castle.
Mm-hmm.
That's really is an amazing turn of events, an amazing change. And
we're definitely inside the castle, and I wanted to mention we have publications like LA Weekly saying that vegan is mainstream. I was reading this online beefmagazine.com with a blog post recently that said vegan and vegetarian is mainstream, and I don't know that it's mainstream, but we're in the castle.
We are in the castle. We're not outside the moat.
That's right. So people can hear us, and that's a good thing. Okay, the last thing I wanted to talk to you about is your favorite foods.
Oh, pasta, pasta, pasta.
He's a pasta guy. Okay.
I am the luckiest person on the... I'm like Lou Gehrig. I'm the luckiest person on the face of the earth. Because my wife is a marvelous cook, and
Nancy Reagan, we love her name.
I always say I'm married to Nancy Reagan, and it's been the best of times and the worst of times to be married to Nancy Reagan. So, but yeah, I'm blessed. I haven't done anything to deserve it. That she's a committed chef, and she loves the challenge of making wonderful vegan food, and she basically makes everything fresh. So
that's the way to do it. Thank you for joining me so much on It's All About Food, Tom. I look forward to seeing you and Nancy again and enjoying some wonderful plant food.
Let's look forward to the day.
That's right. Thank you again.
Again, I'm honored to be on it,
okay.
On your program.
Thank you for everything you've done. Empty Cages, A Case for Animal Rights, all of your great writing. You have made a great difference on this planet. Thank you.
I hope so. I hope I've made some, anyhow.
Okay. Be well. Thank you. And we're going to take a quick break. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Stay with us. I will be right back with Ricky Heller. We're going to talk about allergy-free desserts and candida and all kinds of fun stuff. Everybody, I'm Karen Hartglass, and we're back. It's all about food because it is all about food. You know it, I know it, and I love talking about it. Thanks for joining me. I'm going to bring on my next guest, Ricky Heller. She is an educator, writer, cookbook author, natural nutritionist, lover of all things canine. She's a college teacher who works as a part-time cooking class instructor chef and a part-time freelance writer. She holds a PhD in modern American literature, and she has a website, dietdessertanddogs.com. Welcome to It's All About Food, Ricky.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful introduction.
Well, isn't it true?
Yeah, they are all true.
Yeah.
When you put it all together, you know, it sounds like a lot.
It does. It sounds good. I like people that it sounds like you love life and like to do a lot of things.
I do. I always like to have a full plate, so to speak, yeah.
Yeah, and I get a very positive feeling when I'm on your website.
Oh, great, because that's partly my intention, for sure. Yeah,
yeah, it's a happy place to be.
It is. It is for me, too. I love writing it. I love hearing from my readers. Yeah, I do love blogging.
Okay, so you have, one thing I like is to share people's stories because we like to hear stories. I don't know if it's the voyeur in all of us or what it is, but we relate a lot more to individual stories, and you have one yourself. Maybe you could give us a little brief synopsis of the good,
sure.
the highlights, the lowlights.
Okay. Well, basically, I mean, I guess the way I got to be doing what I'm doing, I call myself a sugar addict. I think that's true. Just like an alcoholic, you're never not a sugar addict once you are one. And, you know, grew up in a home where I just sort of standard American diet, ate a lot of junk food. We loved sweets. My mom was a terrific baker. But unfortunately, what ended up happening as a result of that was, you know, I spent my life being overweight and on a diet and eating a lot of sweet things and, you know, doing a lot of baking myself. So when I was, I guess, in my late 20s, I was diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. Mm. And basically, at the time, what doctors tell you to do for that is just take some pills.
Yeah.
Take laxatives or whatever.
And some very dangerous toxic ones very often that lead to other problems like cancer.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, what they tell you to do is, of course, not going to get rid of the problem, and it's not going to help you much. So, but I did. I mean, I was on medication for 16 years. And
Wow. What
ended up happening was around 40, I ended up having 4 sinus infections in the space of 3 months. And at one point was so ill, I had 104 temperature, and I had been going from doctor to doctor, and they'd given me antibiotics, they didn't seem to be working. And I just, you know, I can vividly remember at the peak of that problem, we came home from one doctor's appointment. My husband had to take me because I was too weak to go, and I literally could not get up the stairs to the bedroom. I had to crawl up on my hands and knees. I was so sick. So at that point, someone told me or said to me, you know, why don't you go see a naturopath? And, of course, I hadn't thought of that before. Mm-hmm. Because I was pretty conventional. And, you know, I went to see someone. She completely changed my diet, and that's sort of what got me started on this road toward holistic nutrition. It did take me about 10 years longer till I really sort of dove right in. But after that, I got a little bit better, changed my diet, and I decided I wanted to study nutrition to find out for myself why some foods were good and some foods weren't good for me. And it wasn't until about 10 years after that that I ended up having a really severe case of candida because I had been doing very well. I'd been eating whole foods diet and feeling great, and I guess I felt so great that I thought, oh, you know, a little bit of the old stuff won't hurt me. And it was Christmas 2008, I remember distinctly, and I just had one little piece of cake, and then that turned into 2 and 5 and chocolate and everything else I had been eating before, and I ended up with a really bad case of candida. And so I've been on the candida diet since March 2009. And
you're doing well.
I'm doing well, yeah. I'd say I'm about 95% back to where I was when I was, you know, healthy. But what's great about being on a whole foods diet, you know, I was able to get off my medication for the irritable bowel when I first changed my diet. It took about 6 months before I was feeling so much better that I decided to try to wean myself off with my doctor. And we also got me off of medication for low thyroid at the time. So I'm basically not on any medication right now, which is terrific. I'm just eating a whole foods diet and taking natural supplements and still being supervised by my naturopath and hoping that I'm probably going to be able to maintain this for the rest of my life.
For the rest of your long, high-quality life.
Let us hope so, yes.
Okay, so I was taking notes while you were talking, and I wanted to talk about a number of things that you mentioned. The first thing was being a sugar addict. And we live today in a world where many people are addicted to foods, especially sugar. And there's a lot of reasons behind it. Some of them are political. Some of them are just the time that we live in. There's a lot of laws that have been passed things have become deregulated. Farmers are growing everything they possibly can without letting pieces of their land rest. Our food system is overloaded with an abundance of food, more than we really need. Food is cheap. It's everywhere. And it's not necessarily the healthiest food that is all around us. And then there's marketing that knows very well how to have those little voices in our head tell us to eat their products. And all of those things work against us. And there's also a lot of science that shows that when we eat more sugary products, we do get addicted.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. All of those things working together. I mean, it starts at the level of the individual. So, you know, if you look at emotional, physiological factors, and in my case, because I'm a little bit older than the young people today who are becoming addicted, when I was a kid, there really wasn't all that much processed food, certainly not in my house because my parents were very old-fashioned. My dad was raised on a farm. But still, we had the emotional factors, and we have the physiological factors of eating sweets every day. My mom was a baker, and my dad wanted baked goods in the house. Mm. You know, so those things work together. And as you were just saying, if you've read David Kessler's book, The End of Overeating, he talks about how addictive sugar is and the sort of triad of sugar, fat, and salt and how they work together to make food so appealing, and how food producers actually use that information and base their recipes upon how much of the food's going to be addictive for us, right? So it's just insane, I think, that this is what we're being offered and this is what we're eating so regularly. And some of the appeal and the draw of this food isn't even voluntary to some extent.
That's right. So the thing is, we shouldn't belittle ourselves if things aren't going our way, because not all of it is our fault. But at the same time, I want to say it is our responsibility. Our health
Absolutely.
Is our responsibility, and we have to take control if we want to feel good, look good, live a long time, and have a high-quality, energetic life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of the problem, too, is that, you know, whole foods aren't as sexy as packaged foods that are made to look beautiful and, you know, they're shaped certain ways and so on. You know, we're not used to eating real food in our society.
Yeah, it's all perspective, though, because I've seen some very sexy cauliflower.
I suppose, yeah, okay, I'll go with that. But even as you were talking, you know, I'm thinking right now my major sweetener in my life is stevia, and it's an herbal sweetener for people who aren't familiar with it. But yeah, I don't know if your listeners are aware, but I'm in Canada, right? So it's slightly different the way stevia is offered here and offered in the States, because mm-hmm. in Canada, the only stevia I've seen is 100% pure extract from the herb. So you can mm-hmm. get a powdered extract, or you can get a liquid, which is basically just the suspension of stevia in some glycerin or alcohol, depending on what they do, because stevia is up to 100 times sweeter than sugar. But what's so fascinating to me is that as soon as stevia was approved in the U.S., I started seeing all kinds of products
yeah.
with stevia, like Truvia and I can't remember, Purevia. And I believe that's partly because you can't patent stevia. But you can patent a combination of stevia
and altered products. Yeah.
So you can't make a lot of money off stevia. So, and I think that's where food manufacturers play a role, because they want things that they can make money off of.
I wanted to just remind my listeners, if you haven't listened to it, several years ago I did speak with Jim May, who's the founder of Sweet Leaf Stevia. He taught me, and he told me that it's pronounced stevia, even though we all pronounce it stevia.
Is that so? I've heard it both ways, and
Jim
I wasn't
says
sure.
Yeah, he says it's stevia, and he was the one who brought it to North America, at least that's what he says.
Oh,
and
he had
a really hard time getting it approved. And mm-hmm. and now there's all these other companies that are, you know, taking market share away from him, who did all of the groundwork. But you can
wow.
you can learn a lot about that product from that show. And I just go to responsibleeatingandliving.com, my website, and put in Jim May or stevia, and that show will come up.
Great.
And stevia is a great product. The downside is that it still allows us to have a sweet tooth.
Yes.
Probably more than natural.
Well, I mean, I think we naturally do have a sweet tooth. You know, one of the things I talk about sometimes when I do talks about sugar and cooking, you know, low glycemic and whatnot. You know, if you think about the very first food most of us have at our mother's breast, mother's milk is very,
very sweet.
So we're sort of hardwired to like sweet. And I think the problem occurs when we have an abundance of it available, much more so than would be naturally available to us. So we tend to consume it way more than we ever could before in history. But you're right. I think, of course, stevia allows you to enjoy sweet food. But I have to say, for me, it was a lifesaver, because you know, mm-hmm. if I hadn't had that as my sweetener, and which allowed me to still enjoy many familiar sweet treats, I probably wouldn't have been able to stay on the candida diet as much, as well as I did and as long as I did in order to start healing.
Right. There are a lot of different fruits out there, and many of them have been hybridized to be sweeter. I personally mm-hmm. tend to stick towards berries, which aren't as sweet as others, although I eat all kinds of fruits, but I don't eat a lot of the sweeter fruits. They're more treats for mm-hmm. me. But fruits are a good food. I don't want to scare anyone away from simple fruits. So the next thing I wanted to talk about is you mentioned you went to a naturopath, and I want to congratulate you for thinking outside of the box. So many people feel like, you know, there's one doctor in the world, the one that they're going to, and they have to listen to whatever he or she says. Mm-hmm. It's so important to get different opinions and try and make sense of it all. There is no one right answer, and not even I've heard a lot of different things from different naturopaths. Some of them have favorite diets, hunter-gatherer or paleolithic or, you know, one thing or another. And I don't agree with what all of them say, but it does enable you, it empowers you to consider all kinds of different things.
I would agree. I think it's really important. Well, and certainly I came to that conclusion after having gone to certainly more than a dozen doctors, none of whom could help me rid myself of this candida, and it was the naturopath who was able to help me. So I think, and the other thing that I've come to realize, having been on this diet for so long and having heard from so many people, it seems to be something that's increasing in numbers, but that no one diet works for every individual either. So even people, there are probably at least a dozen different candida diets out there. If you do a Google search on the internet, you'll find many, many different versions of this diet. Some allow fruit in the first stages, some don't allow fruit in the first stages. Some allow certain nuts and not other nuts, and so on. So what I found was you really also have to tailor the diet to you individually, and what works for me may not always work for someone else, even if we're both following a candida protocol.
It's very true. The other thing I wanted to mention is you said you were on a vegan diet for a long time and then you weren't well and your doctor was insisting that you eat meat and change your diet.
Right.
What I want to mention is that not all vegan diets are healthy. There are variations and again, there it depends on the individual. I was a long-term vegan on what I considered a healthy diet and a very healthy diet, and still I came down with advanced ovarian cancer, and I lived to talk about it. I believe that my diet saved my life, but, you know, there were other factors that came into play, and the thing is we're vulnerable as humans, and things happen, and the thing is that the goal, I think, is to enjoy our lives, live a long quality life, and figure out how to do that.
Yeah, not to, you know, be trite, but there, you have to find the balance. Like when I was first in university, and when I didn't even know I was a vegan when I was in university, and I was a vegan, but I was a junk food vegan, and that's when I got sick, and that's when my doctor told me I had to go out and eat meat. And then I realized after I'd gone to nutrition school that, you know, I finally understood how horrible my diet had been, and that's when I decided with my newfound knowledge I was going to try again and see why did I have to eat meat? I didn't think, knowing what I knew at that point, I didn't think I had to eat meat anymore. I was able to disagree with her. So, and you know, I feel great now. I feel like I'm eating a well-balanced diet. I'm getting all the nutrients I need. I'm getting enough protein without having a problem with that at all. And so I think it's all, you know, it's all what you know and the kind of diet you're eating, sure.
Okay, let's talk about my favorite subject, which is delicious food.
Okay, mine too.
And I've been to your website, Diet Dessert N Dogs. That's the letter N. Diet Dessert, the letter N, dogs.com. And most recently, you have some really beautiful recipes up for Halloween. I saw those beautiful little pumpkin cupcakes.
Oh, thank you. The whoopie pies. Well, one of the things that's been going around the internet is a pumpkin-shaped cake made of two Bundt cakes set bottom to bottom. And so I thought, oh, well, you know, I don't want to do a whole big cake, but what if I could do individual servings? So I bought a miniature Bundt pan, and I made whoopie pies out of them. But the thing about those, I don't know if you looked at the ingredients, that is a recipe, as someone now who is following what I call stage three of the Candida diet. So I do allow myself to have some coconut sugar on occasion, which is a low glycemic sweetener, or coconut nectar. And so this is a cake, a vegan cake made with coconut sugar and stevia as the sweeteners, and it is a frosting that's made out of coconut butter and sweet potato and stevia as the sweetener. And it is fluffy and light, and it's like a frosting. So my husband thought he was eating orange buttercream because I used orange flavored stevia as a sweetener. And to me, that's both fun and delicious. I just love being able to recreate recipes that people will be surprised to learn are vegan or surprised to learn are healthy.
Right.
So I don't even want them to know that these are healthy unless I tell them.
Oh, sure. You want to give them the treat, and they're like, oh, it's a treat. It's good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So for me, that's just fun. And I think, you know, as long as you can have those kinds of treats in your life, and the first time I was on this diet, I remember feeling very deprived and always whining when my husband and I went out to dinner. I couldn't eat what I want. But this time around, I think I finally embraced this as I said, something I'm going to do for the rest of my life, because I'm just constantly amazed at how well you can eat without sugar and without refined flours and without all the other bad stuff.
I want to say something that I believe in. If you're in a severe health crisis, you're feeling absolutely horrible, or you're facing what could be a terminal illness, I believe that you have to get really serious about your diet. And and even still, that doesn't mean that the food isn't going to be enjoyable, but there's food that you really shouldn't be having if you really want to get well. And I did that for a year and a half. I didn't eat any sugar. I ate very few fruits, just the berries. And I stayed away from refined foods. I was eating a lot of greens, limited whole grains, lots of greens. I underlined the greens, raw and fresh. And I was on a lot of nutritional supplements. But then after that, I opened, I don't want to say the floodgates, but I allow myself treats. And on my responsibilityandliving.com website, you can see some of them. I do a lot of gluten-free baking. I do use evaporated cane juice. It's not good for everybody, but you can allow yourself some special foods, and you have to know that they're treats. That's what makes them special when you don't have them all the time.
Exactly. And I think, you know, as I was saying earlier, I think that's the problem with the average diet in North America today, is that we do have them all the time. You know, we have sugar for breakfast, sugar for lunch, sugar for dinner, sugar for snacks, all the time. And that's the way I certainly was eating. You know, one of the things in one of the stories on my blog, I talk about when I was an undergrad, my roommate and I, we used to go out and buy layer cake on Friday afternoon from the local supermarket, and that's what we ate all weekend.
Well, I remember when I was in college, I lived on coffee and ice cream and, you know, all those treats. But, you know, the wonderful thing about the human body is how forgiving it is. If you catch it in time, you really can turn things around dramatically. We just have a minute. I wanted to just ask you, you have a cookbook that's coming out soon. What's that about?
Oh, yes. This is an updated, revised version of Sweet Freedom, which was my first cookbook. So it's going to be a book of gluten-free and refined sugar-free, refined everything-free desserts and baked goods. So from breakfast baking down to the fancy desserts for when you have people over for dinner. And it's scheduled to come out in October of 2013, so a year from now.
Okay. We'll look for it. Thank you, Ricky Heller. We're at the end of the show. Thank you for joining me. Go to her website, diet, dessert, and dogs.com. And I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Make a donation if you can, and have a very delicious week. Bye-bye.